Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Welcome, everyone, to the deep dive. Let's start with a question, okay? Think about those really high-stakes public interactions. You know, when things are tense, emotions are flared up, everything's on the line. What's the one skill, the single most crucial thing that makes the difference between things going sideways and a peaceful resolution? You might jump to thinking about physical strength or maybe knowing all the rules, the laws, maybe even just being brave. But the surprising truth, and this is what we're really diving into today, is communication. That's the real superpower here. So today we're doing a really unique deep dive. We're looking at the art, but also the science of verbal persuasion and how to interact effectively in public. And our sources, well, they're not your usual self-help books. We're actually drawing from specialized training materials for peace officers, stuff focused specifically on verbal communication and force options. And this gives us this incredible lens, you know, to see how trained professionals handle really complex, sometimes volatile human encounters. Our mission is to pull out those key insights, those nuggets of wisdom from these practical guides to really understand why some interactions de-escalate, build understanding, get compliance, while others just spiral. Think of this as your shortcut, really, to understanding human connection, conflict resolution, and the huge power of those unspoken messages we send all the time.
And what's so illuminating about using these sources is that, well, we're looking at a field where communication isn't just, you know, a nice skill to have. It's literally the difference between safety and danger, between someone complying peacefully or resisting, sometimes even life and death. These aren't just theories debated in a classroom. These are techniques that have been tested, refined, under immense pressure in the real world. So looking at these specific training materials, it gives us a really practical, high-impact view of communication principles in action. It shows what actually works when everything is truly on the line. It's a fascinating window.
Okay, so let's unpack this with some numbers that honestly might surprise you. They really challenge common perceptions. When you picture, say, a peace officer's day, what comes to mind? Maybe chases, physical stuff, dramatic arrests. And yeah, sure, that happens sometimes. But it's a tiny fraction of their reality. The source material lays out this really compelling statistic. A full 97% of an officer's duties involve verbal skills, talking, listening, explaining. Only about 3%, just 3, of their contacts actually require any physical force. That's a huge imbalance, right? And it completely shifts how we should think about policing and, frankly, about effective interaction in general.
Exactly. And if we connect that to the bigger picture, it just hammers home this universal principle. Verbal mastery. That's the real superpower in resolving conflict, not just for officers, for everyone. These numbers, they don't just challenge ideas about policing. They challenge our assumptions about human interaction overall. They strongly suggest that most successful outcomes, even arrests, happen without any physical force at all. And that's not by accident. It shows how incredibly successful and strategically vital verbal strategies are for getting voluntary compliance. It's not about the force they can use. It's about what they overwhelmingly do use, communication. And this applies everywhere, doesn't it? Handling a tricky conversation at home, dealing with an upset customer, mediating workplace disagreements. That ability to communicate well, to persuade rather than just coerce, it's fundamental to navigating the world effectively, no matter what you do.
That's a really crucial point. So when we communicate, when we try to get a message across, what actually makes up that message? We tend to focus just on the words, right? The things we actually say. But the sources break it down into 3 essential parts, and how much each part matters might really surprise you. It definitely challenges that words-only idea. First, there's content. That's the literal words you use, the dictionary meaning. Second, there's voice. And this is way more than just sound. It's paralinguistics, your tone, inflection, how fast you talk, pitch, timing, even if you hesitate. And third, maybe the most powerful, nonverbals. This is all the body language stuff. Facial expressions, eye movement, posture, the whole silent show.
And this leads us straight to Dr. Albert Mehrabian's famous 7%, 38%, 55% rule. It's a huge concept in communication, and it features heavily in this training. For anyone not familiar, basically his research suggests only a tiny 7% of a message's total impact comes from the actual words. A much bigger chunk, 38%, comes from the voice, tone, pitch, pace, all that. And then a massive 55% comes from nonverbal cues, body language, face, eyes. So connecting that to the bigger picture, what does it mean? It means roughly 93% of how your message is actually received and interpreted comes down to how you say it, not just what you say. Just think about that for a second. The words you maybe agonize over, less than 10% of the impact. It's the silent stuff, the subtle signals, often sent totally unconsciously, that carry most of the meaning, that shape how people really understand you. And this isn't just academic. For an officer or anyone in a tense situation, knowing this is critical for how they operate.
Exactly. And the training gives this great mental exercise to make that rule feel really real. Imagine you've crafted the perfect words, calm instructions, vital info. Okay, give that, it's 7%. Now, what if you say those perfect words, but your voice has this edge of sarcasm, even a little bit? That sarcasm part of your voice could instantly wipe out, say, 30% of your voice's positive impact. And maybe your body language is negative too. You look tense, arms crossed, maybe a frown. That could kill another 30% of your nonverbal impact. So what's the result? What's the caliber of your message now? You started with perfect words, right? But because of those strong negative signals from voice and body, you're only getting maybe 67% of your intended meaning across. That's a major communication breakdown, even with flawless wording. It's like handing someone a gift with a scowl.
And this is precisely why the sources emphasize. When words clash with body language, always believe the nonverbals. Always. Why? Because it's much harder to consciously control your body language. It often bubbles up subconsciously, revealing your real mood, your true attitude, your actual intent. Faking sincerity with your body, much harder than faking it with words. And we humans, we do this rapid assessment, almost instinctively, especially with new people or intense moments. We're kind of wired for it. Generally, we size someone up in a specific order. First, we look at their face and overall body language, then how they sound their voice, then finally the words they choose. And all along, we're subconsciously standing for disconnects. Does the body match the voice? Do the words match the delivery? We're trying to figure out if they're safe, truthful, trustworthy. What's their real intent? So this raises a really critical question for all of us, doesn't it? Are you actually aware of the silent messages your body is sending out constantly? Are you aware of how those signals might be completely undermining your carefully chosen words, maybe without you even realizing it?
Because if not, you're missing, well, 93% of the conversation.
Wow. That's definitely something to keep in mind in, well, every conversation. So, okay, moving beyond the mechanics of the message and those nonverbals, let's shift focus. Let's talk about the internal state that really makes effective communication possible, especially when things get tough. We're talking about emotional intelligence, EQ. What exactly is emotional intelligence, and why is it so absolutely fundamental, not just for officers, but for anyone who wants to communicate better and de-escalate conflict?
The training materials define it really clearly. EQ is the ability to recognize, understand, and manage our own emotions. And critically, to recognize, understand, and influence the emotions of others. It's presented as the absolute cornerstone, the foundation for effective communication, especially in de-escalation. And what's really striking here is how EQ isn't just framed as, you know, a good personal trait. It's positioned as an operational prerequisite for de-escalation. It's that disciplined self-mastery that lets someone stay calm in chaos, using their own emotional control as a tool to cool down the whole interaction. It turns a personal skill into an external force. People with high EQ, and specifically officers with high EQ, are just demonstrably more successful at achieving peaceful outcomes. Why? Because they have strong self-awareness, knowing their own attitudes, biases. They have strong self-control, especially under pressure. They stay motivated. They show social competence and real empathy. They can genuinely see things from another's view. They work to understand others' emotions and what's driving them. And all this internal mastery lets them influence others positively. It absolutely starts from within.
Yeah, and the sources really hammer home the importance of what they call attitude and emotional wellness. It's about owning your attitude, choosing to respond proactively, not just reactively, and crucially, avoiding what they call being enemy-centered, letting someone else's negativity or hostility dictate your own feelings and actions. They even introduced the simple but really useful acronym, HLLT. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. These are pinpointed as moments when your EQ is likely compromised, when your decision-making, your judgment, your ability to communicate clearly can really suffer. If you, or the person you're dealing with, is in one of those HLLT states, productive, rational conversation becomes incredibly difficult.
Absolutely. Just think about the challenge, whether you're an officer or just navigating a family issue, of trying to communicate with someone operating from that low EQ space. Maybe they're really upset, maybe under the influence, maybe in a crisis. Their emotional brain is just dialed way up. When that happens, their cognitive, rational brain usually dials way down. Understanding that inverse relationship, that delicate balance between emotion and intellect, is so, so important. And conversely, the training stresses how an officer's own low EQ, if they are hungry, angry, lonely, tired, or let their own emotions run wild, can completely torpedo de-escalation efforts. If the officer gets sucked into that reactive emotional spiral, mirroring the upset person, well, productive outcomes become much less likely. Things can escalate fast. So the deep self-awareness and rigorous self-control aren't just nice-to-haves in this line of work. They're non-negotiable for effective communication, for conflict resolution, and for everyone's safety. It's about being that calm center.
Okay, so building on that foundation of self-awareness, self-management, let's talk about a tool that's maybe underestimated but incredibly powerful for de-escalation. It taps right into our basic human needs. Personalized respect. The sources are really emphatic about this. All humans, doesn't matter their background, their situation, their behavior right now, have this deep innate need for respect and acknowledgement. Showing genuine respect, communicating it openly, can completely change the dynamic of an interaction. It can position the person showing respect, the officer, in this context as a positive force in the situation, not an adversary.
Yeah, the materials state very clearly that some people will fight, literally become physically aggressive, simply because they feel disrespected. So the insight here is huge. Not being the trigger for that fight by actively demonstrating genuine, personalized respect is a critical safety tactic. And no, this isn't huggy-feely nonsense, as some might dismiss it. It's highly practical. It's evidence-based. It works. It means acknowledging your situation, their perspective, maybe their feelings, even if you completely disagree with their actions or behavior. You're validating their humanity, not necessarily their choices. The training offers concrete phrases. I hear and understand what you're saying. Or, thanks for your input. I see where you are coming from. A really powerful one. I respect you for sharing that. It took courage to tell me.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, look, it's not about agreeing with them. It's not validating something wrong or illegal. It's about acknowledging them, their presence, their emotional stake, their perception of reality. That act disarms defensiveness. It opens a channel.
It recognizes that, from their viewpoint, they probably feel they have reasons for acting the way they are, even if those reasons seem irrational or wrong to you. That acknowledgement is key.
That leads really nicely into another distinction the training makes, which is subtle, but really critical in how influence works. It's about how you want to be perceived. Do you want to be seen as authoritative or authoritarian? The difference is huge, and the training is clear on which one actually works better.
Right. The sources define authoritarian basically as demanding strict obedience. Think dictator, tyrant. So by imposing your will through force, control, maybe intimidation, it thrives on fear, discourages questions. Authoritative, on the other hand, means you're trusted, seen as accurate, reliable. You command presence. An authoritative person is self-confident. They build credibility through knowledge and consistent, fair actions. Because of that, they're likely to be respected and obeyed, not out of fear, but because they seem correct and stable. So this raises a really important question for anyone trying to influence or lead, right? Are you building trust? Are you encouraging voluntary compliance through respect and competence? Or are you just imposing your will, demanding obedience because of your position? The goal, according to this training, should always be voluntary compliance, cooperation, collaboration, and an authoritative presence built on ethics, competence, fairness is just infinitely more effective at achieving that long term. It fosters better relationships, even in tough situations. It's about earning respect, not demanding it.
Let's unpack that authoritative approach a bit more. The training points out two things that seem small, but can have this huge, almost outsized impact on building rapport, connecting, and getting compliance. Just using someone's name and offering a sincere apology seems simple, but their power, especially when things are tense, is apparently immense.
Oh, absolutely. The sources are crystal clear about the power of a name. Using someone's name, it signals recognition. It immediately makes the interaction personal, not just procedural. It communicates value, dignity to that person. Dale Carnegie said it best, right? A person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. And using it when it's appropriate and done genuinely actually makes people more likely to agree, cooperate, comply. The training even suggests if you're unsure, don't just guess first or last name. Ask directly, what name do you use? That shows maximum respect right off the bat. It starts building that connection, making them feel seen and valued instantly.
Okay, and what about apologizing? I think for a lot of people, especially maybe those in authority, saying sorry feels like weakness, like admitting fault undermines you. Is that how the training sees it?
Not at all. The sources are really direct. Apologizing is a sign of self-confidence, maturity, good character. Full stop. People with genuine high self-esteem, they admit mistakes. People with low self-esteem, they often deny them because they fear it makes them look bad. It seems counterintuitive to some, I know, but admitting an error or even just expressing regret for the situation maybe saying, I'm sorry if I made a mistake, that wasn't my intention, or I'm sorry things got to this point. That can dramatically disarm a tense situation. It can catch people off guard, but in a good way. It shifts the whole dynamic away from confrontation. And just as important is how you accept an apology, professionally. Acknowledge it verbally and non-verbally. Don't smirk or brush it off. Reinforce that positive communication. What's fascinating here is how these simple acts, using a name, saying sorry, just cut through defensiveness. They foster real human connection. They often break down barriers in a surprising positive way, creating that space needed for de-escalation, understanding, and ultimately voluntary compliance. Powerful tools, really.
Let's shift gears a bit now and look at the core operational framework that officers use. It's like a dynamic roadmap for handling situations, focusing on de-escalation but also response. The source material talks about two main mindset modes that guide how an officer approaches things.
Right, these two modes are verbal persuasion and recognition and react. Verbal persuasion is the default. It's the primary mode. The goal here is voluntary compliance, achieved through skillful communication. This involves structured approaches like the 7-step contact we'll talk about, frameworks like PACE, which we'll also get into, and LEAPS. LEAPS stands for listen, empathize, ask, paraphrase, and summarize. Really key active listening skills. It also includes crucial tactics like deflection and redirection, especially for handling verbal abuse. We'll touch on that too. The whole idea here is using words, empathy, active listening to guide things peacefully, to avoid needing force if at all possible. Recognition and react, though, that's a tactical shift. You switch to this mode when there's an immediate threat or what the training calls SAFER violations. SAFER is another important acronym. Security, like officer safety compromised, attack, imminent or actual, flight, subject trying to escape, excessive repetition, they just keep resisting verbal commands, or inherent high risk. When a SAFER violation happens, the focus shifts.
Now you're thinking about force options. Controlled tactics, more immediate de-escalation that might involve physical steps. If we connect this to the bigger picture, understanding this flow, this switch between persuasion and reaction, allows officers to be adaptive, not rigid or jumpy. It's a dynamic system. They're constantly assessing, adjusting their mode based on how things unfold, always prioritizing verbal solutions when it's safe.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. The training details a structured approach called the 7-step professional contact. And like you said, this isn't just for law enforcement. It seems like a really adaptable model for almost any interaction where you need to manage a situation, get info, gain cooperation, a clear roadmap.
It really is. It provides such a valuable mental anchor, especially when things feel chaotic or unpredictable. It ensures you hit the key communication and info gathering points. Let's walk through the steps. 1, introduction, your first impression, setting the tone. Professional demeanor, non-verbals, maybe those peace phrases we mentioned. 2, contact reason. Clearly state why you're there, why the contact, removes confusion, gives context. 3, their chance to justify, explain, respond. This is huge. Highlight it as vital for rapport. You actively listen here. Let them tell their story. Make them feel heard, respected. This is where LAPTIF, listen, empathize, ask, paraphrase, summarize really comes into play. 4, ID info. Getting identification, often procedural, but as we'll see, it could be tricky. 5, additional info. Gathering more details relevant to the situation.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Beyond just the ID. 6, evaluate and make a decision. Processing everything, what you heard, what you saw, the context to decide how to proceed. 7, close the contact, ending the interaction professionally, making sure next steps are clear, leaving a good final impression if possible. What's fascinating is how this structure, even in fluid situations, gives you that mental framework. It shows how good communication directly supports practical needs, like getting required info. It brings predictability to unpredictable moments.
And speaking of getting ID, step 4, the sources spend a good amount of time on the challenge of failure to identify and these clever strategies for winning the name game. What happens when someone says they have no ID or gives fake info or just flat out refuses? That must come up a lot.
Oh, it's incredibly common. And the training treats it not just as a roadblock, but as a real test of communication and strategic thinking. Now, this specific source mentions Texas law about identifying yourself, but the core idea applies widely. Officers often need to legally get someone's identity. The real skill the training focuses on isn't just knowing the law. It's how you verbally navigate that requirement when you hit resistance. It becomes a communication challenge, not just an authority challenge. So they teach these practical de-escalating ways to win the name game if someone says no ID. It's not about shouting louder. It's about persistent, skilled questioning and rapport building. Even then, officers are taught to first check. Do they have ID? Just not on them. What kind? Then ask strategically for other picture IDs. People might carry work badges, school IDs, even library cards, credit cards, insurance cards, bills. Things that might have a name or photo. Still nothing. Then move to asking for different bits of personal info that are harder to fake on the spot. Siblings' names, old addresses, where'd you grow up, maybe even a social security number. And if verbal tactics don't work, then they can use computer checks, license lookups, warrants, vehicle info, criminal history, local records, even calling contacts listed somewhere. This really raises that interesting question about the blend, right? How communication and information gathering constantly support each other in these real-world, often tough situations, like a conversational chess game.
So what about when things really heat up? When you're dealing with frustration, maybe insults, direct resistance, non-compliance, the sources have some pretty direct advice for handling that difficult behavior.
Yeah. The training starts by acknowledging a basic truth. Frustrated people tend to resist. And really upset people. Often they just can't act reasonably in that moment. Trying to appeal to pure logic with someone who's highly emotional usually doesn't work. Just barking commands often triggers more resistance. And the materials point out poor delivery, being too authoritarian, or the officer's own low EQ can quickly make things worse, escalating situations that could have been managed. It's also a critical safety point. Many attacks on officers happen up close, after the person has already signaled intent, often through insults or profanity. So when people use insults, profanity. The training suggests it's often just an expression of deep frustration, maybe fear, or a clumsy attempt to get control or provoke a reaction, the advice. And this is tough in the moment. Don't get emotionally triggered yourself. Instead of reacting to the insult, you rationally assess. Is this verbal aggression just venting, or is it a genuine precursor to a physical attack? Is there a real threat here? Connecting this to the bigger picture, it's about staying focused on your professional goal.
Listening through the profanity for the underlying meaning, what's the frustration about? And rigidly controlling your own urge to react. Don't let their words, their delivery, derail you from the real issue or your objective. It demands real emotional discipline.
That sounds incredibly hard, not taking it personally when someone's yelling insults at you. So how do you respond effectively? Without getting into a shouting match, making it personal, or making things even worse? The sources talk about this technique called deflection and redirection. Sounds powerful, maybe a bit counterintuitive.
It is powerful, and it works by breaking that cycle of escalation. Think of it as a verbal judo move. You use one or two specific deflection phrases. These acknowledge their outburst or frustration without actually agreeing with the insult or the aggression. This gives you a vital split second to mentally reset. Then, and this is key, you use the word boutiti to pivot. To redirect the conversation back to the point you were trying to make, back to your objective, you're taking their negative energy and gently but firmly steering it back to something productive. The training gives examples of these deflection phrases. They're designed to sound empathetic but non-committal. Appreciate that. Bro, appreciate the input. I understand that. I hear that. Oh, I got that. Well, sorry you feel that way. Whoa, time out. Sorry you're having a tough time. Sorry this has happened to you. See, they acknowledge the feeling without validating the behavior. Like Dale Carnegie said, you can't have an argument unless at least two people participate. This is refusing to participate in their argument. Then, after the BT, you use a peace phrase to project empathy and reasonableness while restating your goal.
For everyone's safety, I would like you to. Or, I would appreciate it if you would help me out. And what's really fascinating is how this lets you validate the emotion, the anger, the frustration, without validating the bad behavior or the insults. You keep control of the conversation's flow, stop it from escalating, and keep the focus on the objective, not the drama. It's a really skillful way to disarm verbal attacks.
And while we're on arguments, the sources bring up something many of us probably do, that need to win the argument. Can you actually win our argument based on these insights? And what happens when you try?
The answer from this material is a pretty clear no. You can't really win an argument in a way that leads to good outcomes or builds relationships. The training highlights a key psychological point. Arguments automatically make the other person defensive. And when someone's mind is defensive, it's not creative, it's not cooperative. They're busy protecting their ego, their viewpoint, not looking for solutions or common ground. Surprisingly, logic alone doesn't work well then. When you try to prove someone wrong, especially if you do it forcefully or publicly, you're basically attacking their sense of self-worth. What do? They dig in their heels even more. They become more resistant. So winning the argument often means losing cooperation, losing the chance for a positive relationship, and maybe even making the situation worse. It can also negatively impact the winner, raise stress, cloud thinking. The advice is clear. Avoid flat-out saying you're wrong. Avoid interrupting that screams, I'm not listening, or I don't care. It makes people feel dismissed. This brings up that vital question again. What's your real goal here? Is it stroking your ego by being right? Or is it getting compliance, building connection, finding a productive solution? The sources also touch briefly on officer profanity. Basically, avoid it. It usually backfires, negatively affects how people see you, including bystanders, raises stress for everyone, and can even hinder the officer's own thinking. Any perceived power often comes from the assertive tone, not the swear words themselves. Professionalism and clarity are better.
That difference between winning an argument and getting a good outcome is just so important, isn't it? Okay, let's dive into another really comprehensive framework from the training. It guides officers through basically every encounter. It's called the PACE-E framework. PACE-E stands for Problem, Audience, Constraints, and Ethical Presence.
Yeah, PACE is incredibly useful. It's a holistic way to approach any interaction, like a mental checklist for navigating complex situations. Let's break it down. First, P, problem. This is about quickly analyzing and identifying the core issue right now, what needs to be addressed. This includes assessing risks, spotting those pre-attack cues, remember safer, security, attack, flight, excessive repetition, risk, and understanding the legal context. And crucially, the problem can change fast, so the officer has to avoid making it personal. Stay objective. Focus on what's important now. Win. Cut through the noise. Second, A, audience. This is about reading the people involved. Who are potential allies here? Who are adversaries? The sources talk about recognizing broad types. Nice people. Cooperative, maybe just confused. Difficult people. Resistant, emotional, but maybe not a physical threat. And sly people. Deceptive, manipulative. Recognizing these helps tailor the approach. A difficult person might need deflection. A nice person might just need clear info. They also suggest enlisting help from friends or family on scene if you can. Third, C, constraints. These are all the things in the environment or situation that make connection and compliance harder. Think physical setting, distractions, noise. But also a key point. Everyone there, officer, subject, bystanders, is under some kind of influence. Stress, emotions, maybe substances, the pressure of the moment. Officers work under unique stress. Talking to people who don't want to talk, who are highly emotional, may be dangerous, often distrustful, all while being watched. The key here is maintaining disinterest. Not lack of concern, but objectivity. Freedom from personal bias or getting emotionally hooked. Letting people vent frustration without taking it personally. It's not usually about the officer as a person. And fourth, E, ethical presence. This is the culmination. It's the officer's ability to be who they need to be for that situation. It means using professional, tactical language words chosen for de-escalation. Maintaining unwavering self-control, even when provoked. Being authoritative, not authoritarian, with high EQ. Projecting credibility, consistency. Avoiding anything seen as hasty, irrational, unfair. The goal, always voluntary compliance, cooperation, collaboration. This PACE framework, it really shows the complex awareness, the adaptability, the self-mastery needed in these interactions. Mm-hmm. It's not just doing things. It's perceiving, analyzing, adapting constantly.
That framework really does show the depth required. It's way beyond just following steps. Building on that idea of presence, we all hear first impressions matter. But how fast do we really make them? And what's actually going on when we meet someone new, especially in a potentially tense situation?
The sources confirm what experts often say. We size people up incredibly fast, somewhere between just 30 seconds and maybe 2 minutes. And here's the kicker. Reinforcing what we said about Meridian's rule, over 90% of the impression you form in that tiny window has nothing to do with the words spoken. Communication, the training explicitly says, is a performance art. That means your thoughts, your emotions, your physical actions, they all need to be aligned in your delivery. Because most people, especially under stress, operate more from subconscious emotion than pure logic and a bad first impression. It's incredibly difficult to undo. It sets the filter for everything that follows. What's fascinating here is how your internal state, your preparedness, your emotions, and your nonverbals are basically on display before you even open your mouth. People are reading your posture, your face, your eyes, your overall energy long before your words even register fully. That's why having good EQ, being self-aware, and being really intentional about your physical and emotional presence is vital from the absolute first second. You're broadcasting volumes without saying a word.
Okay, so knowing those first seconds are that critical, what are some practical ways to make a good introduction? to create that positive first impression using those peace phrases the sources mentioned.
Yeah, the training offers several really good examples of peace phrases. They're designed specifically to set a positive, non-threatening, empathetic tone right away. They open dialogue instead of imposing authority. They invite cooperation. Things like, "What can I do for you?" immediately offers help. "How can I help you?" shows willingness to understand. Or, "Hi, you're not in trouble. Can I talk to you?" that directly de-escalates and invites conversation. "Can you do me a favor?" frames a request collaboratively. Or even, "What's troubling you today?" directly acknowledges potential distress. These work because they instantly project helpfulness, understanding, empathy. They signal a non-threatening, open approach, not a closed, confrontational one. And that's absolutely crucial for building that positive first impression, laying the groundwork for a productive chat instead of hitting defensive walls right away. They bypass resistance by showing supportive intent.
So pulling all these threads together now, nonverbals, frameworks like PACEY, first impressions, EQ, what does it all mean for actually truly connecting with people, even when it's difficult? The sources reference insights from leadership expert John C. Maxwell on what he calls the four essential components of connection.
Maxwell's framework, as used here, is a great synthesis. It reinforces how all these different pieces have to work together for real impact, real connection. He identifies four key components. One, connecting visually. This hits on that point that people remember 85-90% of what they see. So your professional appearance, your body language, it's paramount. Are you visually approachable, confident, non-threatening? Two, connecting emotionally. This is understanding that people hear your words, sure, but they feel your attitude. Your energy, intensity, conviction, these often matter more than the exact words for motivating someone. You need that emotional resonance. Are you projecting calm, empathy, or maybe tension? Three, connecting verbally. This is everything besides the words themselves. Tone, inflection, timing, volume, pace. These paralinguistic cues shape the meaning and impact hugely. Is your voice reassuring or aggressive? Four, connecting intellectually. This is about knowing your stuff. Your message needs to sound logical, sensible, credible. You need to appear competent, authoritative, not authoritarian. But as we've seen, this is just one piece. It won't work well if the others aren't aligned.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, see, true connection isn't just one thing. It's like a symphony, all these elements playing together harmoniously. If there's a disconnect anywhere, if your body says one thing, your words another, it could totally undermine the whole effort, no matter how good your intentions or wording.
It's so clear that real communication is so much more than just talking. Building on that holistic connection idea, Maxwell also talks about three implicit questions people are always asking themselves about you, subconsciously, in any interaction. They are, do you care about me? Can you help me, Adana? And can I trust you?
Exactly. Those are the fundamental filters. People process everything you do and say through those subconscious questions. And the source material really stresses empathy, that genuine effort to see their perspective, feel what they might be feeling, as the absolute key to answering that first crucial question. Do you care about me? If they don't believe you care, it's almost impossible for them to believe you can genuinely help them or to fully trust you. Your ability to answer all three questions positively, not just with words, but with your entire communication package, posture, tone, actions, demonstrated intent, that's what builds real rapport. That's what leads to voluntary compliance. It really raises that important question for all of us, doesn't it? In our interactions, professional or personal, how consistently are we sending clear, positive answers to those unspoken questions? Through our eye contact, active listening, respectful tone, genuine intent. Are we truly inviting connection, or are we maybe putting up barriers without even realizing it?
And finally, Maxwell points out four common connection limitations, things that often get in the way of effective communication and prevent that genuine connection. These are really insightful because they often come from within ourselves.
Yeah, and these four limitations, they all fundamentally boil down to self-centeredness, which just reinforces that core idea. Effective connection requires shifting focus from self to other. The four are. One, immaturity, not about age, but emotional development. It's defined as the inability to consistently see things from others' perspectives or act on their behalf. Mature people connect with their community. Immature people tend to stay self-absorbed. Two, insecurity. If you're insecure about yourself or your position, your focus turns inward. You worry about your own flaws instead of engaging with the other person's needs or feelings. That self-focus blocks connection. Three, ego. The sources note that public-facing professions can sometimes foster unhealthy egos, and ego acts like a huge wall, preventing real connection. The advice is powerful. Metaphorically, tear down that ego wall and use the stones, that potential for self-importance, to build bridges of genuine relationship instead.
Yeah.
It's about humility, service, not being puffed up. Four, failure to value others. This might be the most basic. Every single person needs to feel valued, important, significant. It's a fundamental human need. If your communication fails to convey that value to someone, you shut down connection immediately. No cooperation, no compliance likely follows. What's really fascinating here is how all four limitations are about the communicator's internal state. Their self-perception directly impacts their ability to connect outwardly. It really highlights that connection isn't just technique, it's about your inner state, your self-mastery, your heart.
What a deep dive that was. We've really journeyed through this unseen language of influence today. From that mind-blowing fact that 93% of impact is how you say something, not just what, to strategic models like the 7-step contact and PACE E, we looked at the simple power of using a name, the unexpected strength in apologizing, the absolute necessity of emotional intelligence. It's so clear that communication isn't just talking. It's a complex, nuanced performance art. And importantly, it's learnable. It's not just luck or talent.
Absolutely. And it's crucial to remember, these principles we explored, even though they came from peace officer training, they apply everywhere. They impact every single relationship and interaction you have. Negotiating at work, sorting out a disagreement at home, even just chatting with someone at the store. Understanding these subtle cues, harnessing the power of respect, prioritizing genuine human connection, it can literally transform your personal and professional life. At the end of the day, effective communication is built on that solid foundation of EQ, self-awareness, and a real, authentic desire to connect meaningfully with other people.
So here's a final thought for you to take away and maybe chew on this week. Think about how often you might be communicating but not truly connecting. And what one small intentional shift maybe in your body language, your tone of voice, or how you show respect could radically change the outcome of your very next interaction. Remember that huge number. 93% of your message's impact comes from how you say it, not just what you say. How will you consciously use that unseen language of influence going forward?
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Warm season's greetings to you all.